For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up this week, with the winner of this year's Philip Carnegie Medal due to be announced in just a couple of weeks, I talk to debut author Manjeet Mann, whose novel Run Rebel is a must-read. Narrator John Cormack shares his favourite reads and his own surprising backstory. And I review a novel with a blind protagonist that's also one of the most popular picks for books of your life. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Run Rebel is the breathtaking debut from Manjeet Mann. Told in verse, it explores intergenerational tension in a British Asian family, and it's been shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal. Manjeet Mann, welcome to Read On.
Thanks for having me.
So can you set the scene and introduce us to your protagonist, Amber?
Yeah, so Run Rebel is a YA novel. It is told in verse, and it's all about a teenage girl called Amber. And Amber is desperate to live her own life on her own terms. However, her home life is far from perfect. So the novel kind of explores the conflict of cultures between her challenging and at times abusive family life at home and a school life, which is full of friendships and teen crushes and this passion for athletics. And throughout the novel, Amber has to learn to navigate these two opposing cultures and really develop the strength to grow and build her own identity in the face of these sort of major obstacles at home.
And from the very outset, we are left in no doubt of the nature of being a woman in the community that she is growing up in. It is described as the curse of being a girl, and it is her burden to wear.
Yeah, definitely. And it's something that through the community work that I do, I realise just still how prevalent it kind of is, that way of thinking. And I had a good question from a school actually earlier this week, and they said, oh, what religion are you? Because is this a religious thing? And I was like, oh, no, not at all. It kind of spans different cultures, West and East as well. And we have it very much here as well in terms of what's expected of you as a woman. And there seems to be a bit of a kind of change in the tide with things now. But obviously, there are some kinds of communities that are still very patriarchal, aren't they? And yeah, this is definitely a book that is inspired by a lot of my own experiences growing up, and definitely the work that I do with women through my organization as well, Run the World. So it just seemed like something that I just had to talk about and I had to write about.
And it seemed very much as an inheritance. We see generations of Amber's family and that position of a girl child being a disappointment goes down through the generations until somebody breaks out. And the frustration that women can feel in their subordinate position can make them allies or make them enemies.
Yeah, definitely. Again, I mean, I'm the youngest of five sisters in my family, so very female, heavy kind of household. And it was definitely the kind of things that were sort of said to me when I was growing up quite often. Sounds really awful, even though I've laughed through it a little bit. But yeah, we would often be told like what a disappointment it was, each of us being born, and when was the boy going to come? And obviously the boy never came. And yeah, my older sisters had a very different upbringing to myself, and I really was the one in the family that challenged everything. And, you know, and I know a lot of people that I went to school with as well, it was very similar. And just in one of my groups that I was teaching last year, actually, there were two young teenage girls that had just come over from Syria, and they were going through the same sort of things as well. You know, they wanted a very different life, and now they're living here and they're seeing different opportunities for themselves. So, yeah, it was a real fight for me, a fight that I won eventually, but it was really, really tough. Just in terms of myself and my older sisters as well, there was that thing of, oh, we're family, but there was also a lot of arguments because they felt hard done by, seeing that I was getting certain freedoms that I was fighting for and then winning the battle. And they were sitting back thinking, no, that's not right. We didn't get that. That's not fair. So that whole being enemies, but, you know, you're also family. Yeah, that's kind of me drudging up my own stories there and trying to tell that story. Because actually, I think it's more prevalent than we like to talk about. So I wanted to shed a bit of light on that, really.
And the tension is shown in Amber's relationship with her older sister, Ruby, who did take the arranged marriage route, partly for a quiet life, partly, we find, to give Amber a little bit of an easier time within the family. Mm. And it is endurance that really comes through. Their mother endures, they both endure. And the question at the heart of this novel is, how much can you endure before you decide to rebel? And the spark for that rebellion is lit in a history lesson at school.
Yeah, gosh, you're so right. It really is about endurance, isn't it? Definitely. And yes, the history lessons, that took a while to get to, actually, because we were sort of working with that with the editor for quite a while, of trying to find that spark in her, what really kind of gives her that push. And of course, it is the running and stuff like that. But it just felt like it needed another thing. And for a long time, it was English lessons, actually, but it wasn't sort of fitting. And then one day I just picked up a book about revolutions and I was like, this is it. This is exactly what it is. She's fighting her own 8 stages of a revolution. And it was just a real spark of sort of genius of that day that suddenly I just found the thing that was really missing in the novel. So I'm really thankful for that book on my shelf about the 8 stages of the French Revolution. So that's kind of what it's based on. And it just shows what I wanted to show was just how much school can really inspire you and how much you can just learn and just put into practice in your own life. And that's just definitely mirrored with the whole 8 stages of the revolution, mirrors what's happening in her own home.
And we see that the stirrings of dissatisfaction are fanned by the freedom that Amber finds as a champion 200 meter runner at school. That is where she learns that freedom can feel good and that sometimes you have to go through a bit of pain to make progress.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not an easy road she has to travel. Just sort of like putting a bit of context to it as well. So Run the World, my organisation, looks to empower women through sport and storytelling because I worked as a personal trainer as well in the past. And I wanted to bring the whole sort of sport and theatre together and see if there was something that I could do working in the community, bringing both of these two skills together. And for me, sport plays a huge part in mental health and feeling good about myself. And once you go out for a run on a day that you really didn't feel like you could go on one, you come back thinking, oh gosh, I can just take on the world. And I saw just how much this was really benefiting the women in my sessions as well, because, you know, when you start these things, you think, well, I feel good, but is anybody else going to feel good? Or are they just going to think I'm a bit weird and I'm wasting their time? But, you know, it really was life changing for these women. And the first group of women that I worked with was a group of women who were survivors of domestic violence. And they made some changes in their home over the year that I was working with them. Like, wow, they made real changes, you know, getting out of really difficult situations into safe houses. You know, they're all at different stages in their recovery. And it was just amazing. I'm not saying I was the only person that was responsible for that, but it played this part working with this particular community centre and women. And it just felt really important for me to put that in there in the book. It felt like it was really part of me. It was part of the work that I was doing at the time. You know, I started writing One Rebel around the same time that I set up the organisation. So it felt really powerful for me.
Like you were giving voice to the testimonials of many of these women.
Yeah, I guess so, definitely. And also at the time, I was helping with a government study that were looking into why teenage girls especially suffer more with ill mental health. And is there a direct correlation between that and sport really dropping off in the teenage years for girls, just in terms of talking about my own experiences? So that was really interesting to me and another reason why I really wanted to put that in there.
Something else that you explore from a rarely looked at vantage point in fiction is bullying and the cycle of violence that bullying can produce. Amber is the hero of the story, and we feel an enormous amount of sympathy for her because we see her pretty awful home life. But she's also a bully. And whilst we understand what she's doing to the girl in her year, we don't like it as readers.
Yeah, definitely. I've been doing a lot of school sessions over the last couple of weeks, and I have to sort of, you know, say to the kids, like, you know, Amber's not always a likable character. You're going to question whether you want to be on her side or not, because she does bully a girl in her class quite horrifically. But I'm really interested in this cycle of violence and this cycle of trauma, more so. Yeah, it's probably a better way of saying it. And again, I was sort of picking up on personal experience there as well. But also, I'm just really, really interested in, just in terms of my own father, I'll talk about that. And he didn't have a good life at all. You could really tell that, you know, he lost his parents really young and wasn't looked after very well with the people who were looking after him, and just turned into this very angry man, which then fed through. And I was a very angry teenager. I know that a lot of teenagers are perhaps quite angry. You know, there's a lot going on. But yeah, I really suffered quite a lot. And I was a bully. I'm ashamed to say I was a bully, and I was bullied. So I sort of got both ends of that, really. So I just wanted to explore that and just kind of go, I mean, I'm not excusing it at all. But there's reasons for this sort of behaviour. And if I really think about myself as a kid, I was like, God, I was so unhappy. I was so unhappy, so sad all the time. And I couldn't talk about this sadness. I had nobody to talk to. I remember one girl just the other day said, did you like school? And I said, yeah, I loved it because it was my sanctuary. You know, it was an escape for me, but I couldn't talk to anybody about what was happening at home. So in the first few years of secondary school, I was bullied. And in the latter years, I then bullied. And it is this cycle of trauma. And it's something that I'm writing about now, but for adults now, is something that I'm working on, is an adult project. But I just sort of think as well, to make your heroine flawed makes them more realistic as well. Then you question yourself and you question everything that's happening around you and just sort of like think, well, nobody's perfect.
And that's something that many readers might associate a little bit more with drama, either on the stage or on television. And I know that you had a very successful play called A Dangerous Woman. Does Run Rebel feel like it's grown out of your work in the theatre? Does it feel like, I don't want to say a one-woman show, but perhaps it is?
Yeah. And I think you're right. It really did grow out of A Dangerous Woman, I'll be honest. And obviously A Dangerous Woman was an autobiographical show. Run Rebel isn't 100% autobiographical, but there, you know, there is a lot of me in there. And definitely, I think the performer in me was writing in verse because it's quite performative. And there I am just speaking all my words out loud as I'm typing away. And I'm visualizing it on stage. Definitely. Yeah, I think it was born out of what I know, really, which is the theatre. You know, I'm a theatre actress, haven't really done much screen. That's why I like verse novels, I think. And that's probably why I wrote it in verse, was because it just feels more visual and it just makes you want to get up and speak it out loud. And I like that. And we are actually turning it into a play. It's in the very early stages. So that's quite exciting.
And you bring it brilliantly to life as an audiobook. I know that you've narrated other people's books in the past, but how was it narrating your own?
Oh, it was great, I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, I really, really loved it, because I felt as though I'd sort of lived and breathed it for the 2.5 years that it took to write it. I think it was the week after we'd signed it off and it had gone to print that I then sat in the studio and then read it. And so it felt like a really nice sort of tying a bow on it, really, and just finishing it off. Yeah, I would have hated it if somebody else read it. I would have been really upset if they wanted a famous actress. I would have gone, no!
No one wanted Ruby. No one wanted me. My sister Ruby and I have heard the stories. The sadness that cloaked our births. The prayers and temple visits wishing we would come out as boys. So we are born in all our feminine form and reminded of our burden. Every day. We are obedient. We are small. we are quiet, to prove we are not a burden. We are still reminded that we are a burden. It eats away at you.
Manjeet Mann narrating her novel in verse, Run Rebel.
So, Manjeet, I understand that there are some visual aspects to the paperback. Could you describe some of those for blind readers?
I think what's great about verse novels is, and the fact that most of them are all free verse, aren't they? So they're takes away all the rules, rhyming structure or meter. You know, they can be as long as you want or as short as you want. Some of them are just like a word, and you can set them out on the page as you want. So there are some pages where I do like dual narrative. So on one page, I'll have Amber has got her thoughts on something, and then Mum will have her thoughts on the same thing, and they're usually at odds with each other. Or sometimes I've got all three characters, so I'll have Mum, Ruby and Amber, and it's the same sort of narrative that they're all telling, but from their own point of view, but they're all set out on the same page, almost like a column going down. Also, there are pages that are darker, so we have sections where Mum and Ruby come in with their own voice telling their own stories, and those pages are darker. They're sort of like a dark grey as opposed to the cream colour of all the rest of the pages. And there are some poems where Amber's saying one thing in the poem, but then there are certain letters that stick out in bold on the page, and they'll tell you what she's really thinking. So there's one poem where she's talking about how she feels really great. Maybe the future's looking bright, but actually in bold, the letters, the words come out, I don't feel safe. So the words that come out are actually at odds with what she's saying in the poem. So yes, I think those are the main visual things in the book.
And that's why it is so important that you narrate the audiobook version, because you know that all those things are there, and I certainly didn't feel that we were missing out on any of those aspects because you brought them to the fore in your narration with a little bit of use of special effects in poems like Secret Crush.
Oh good, I'm glad that you didn't feel like you missed out.
On the contrary, actually, I think I would be recommending the audiobook over the text copy, but maybe that's just me.
No, that's fine. I don't mind. However anybody wants to consume it.
Many more people will be consuming the book because it has been shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal, alongside novels by people who I guess might be your heroes, like Jason Reynolds and Liz Acevedo.
Yes, definitely. And those two, definitely. Yeah, I mean, all of them. Gosh, you've got a whole list of people there that have been nominated and shortlisted like numerous times. So yeah, I'm not thinking at all that I'll get any further than this shortlist. I'm just so happy that I've been shortlisted, because there's some real heavyweights, is what I've been saying. There's some real heavyweights on that shortlist. I'm just really pleased that Run Rebel sort of crawled in there and that people like it. Yeah.
I'd argue that it has strode in there like it's still got another lap in its legs, but that's obviously for the judges to decide. However, I get the impression that, having mentioned libraries as often as you do in the book, you must be particularly happy that so many children and young adults are reading the book through the shadowing scheme.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's so fantastic. I've been getting lots of reviews being sent to me through social media, actually, that the young adults have written. They're just incredible. Like, they really get it. And it's really sort of like moving them. And they're just sort of really having empathy for the characters. And they're sort of saying that it's really powerful and that it's inspired them to fight for the life that they want to live. That was something that somebody put in their review just yesterday that was shared with me. And I just sort of think, oh, this is why I wrote the book, and I'm just so pleased that it's getting into the hands of children. Yeah, it's really overwhelming, actually.
Literature is such a good way of helping people, especially young people, find their identity. And that certainly seems to beat at the heart of this book. The importance of making one's own choices and striving for better things. Do you have a favourite poem in the book that you feel encapsulates that message?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Do you know what one of my favourite poems is, though? I'm not too sure if it encapsulates everything, but I feel like it definitely does have that kind of just be proud in your own skin and be proud of who you are and stand in your own strength and power. It's Bina. I really like the poem Bina. I like, so she's that girl. It's because it's really come from my childhood and just sort of like sitting at the temple and just hearing all the aunties talking about, well, that girl's done that and that girl's done that and that girl's done that. And then there's this one girl who we would all go, she's very westernized. And really, it's just because she went to uni and cut her hair, you know, maybe she wears makeup. But that one girl that I always wanted to talk to and just be like, tell me how to get out of here. Yeah, and she was just like really tough and she didn't care what all the aunties were saying about her. So I love that, and I guess that is kind of like the motto of the book, really. It's like, fight for the life you want to live and just don't listen to all these other voices. So yeah, that was a long answer to saying Bina. I love the poem Bina.
Well, Manjit Mann, thank you so much for coming onto the show and taking us further into the world of Run Rebel. And many, many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Sillett Carnegie Medal.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really lovely.
Run Rebel by Manjit Mann is available now from the RNIB Library. And Manjit will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading the Talking Books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day. Only on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come this week, I overcome my reluctance and review a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Anthony Doerr. But before that, one of the best aspects of working at the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Camden was that I got to meet many of my favourite narrators in person. With luck, those days will return soon. But in the meantime, let's go back to the day that I met a narrator with an interesting history of voicing other people's words.
With over 120 talking books to his name, John Cormack will be a familiar voice to many listeners. His range is enormous. From hard-edged thrillers to stories for young children, taking in autobiography, poetry and fantasy along the way. Keen to find out what he's currently working on, I caught up with him during a break in recording at the RNIB Camden Studios. John Cormack, welcome to the Read On Studio.
Great to be here.
So what are you working on in the Talking Book Studio?
At the moment, I'm recording a Northern Irish crime novel by a writer I've recorded some of his work before called Adrian McKinty. And they're set in Belfast in the 80s, and they're quite irreverent, full of black humour. Lots of Northern Irish characters, which I quite like doing. So that's quite fun. So I'm having a ball with it, actually. Yeah, it's lovely. Comes off the page really well.
You've done quite a lot of thrillers. I was looking through the 120 books that you've recorded.
I had no idea. Is it really that? Oh, Lord, man and boy.
Well, I just presume you're keeping very busy, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
But yeah, you've done quite a lot of thrillers. I notice actually there are some of the great horse racing authors there. John Frankham, bit of Dick Francis.
I like to do good literature. Yes. No, well, actually, the horse racing thing was quite nice because my dad, my dear departed dad, was a big racing fan, and I live near Newmarket, which he used to call headquarters, so I used to go racing with Dad, so I have a little bit of racing knowledge. I never make any money, but you know.
And you recorded the Willie Carson autobiography as well.
I did.
Was that fun?
I have very little memory of it. A lot of it was Willie, without being libelous, Willie's ego is quite large. Larger than he is.
He is a jockey.
I know. No, no, completely. That's kind of, it's prerequisite for the job, isn't it? I know. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, and you've recorded an awful lot of sporting autobiographies. I noticed George Best was in there, good, the bad and the bubbly.
That's right. Yeah, poor old Georgie. Well, Georgie was my, a lot of those books are quite badly written, let's face it. But George Best was, I'm of an age where George Best was my hero. And I wanted to be George Best. And I was so lucky when I was 12, my dad brought me to London and I saw George Best play. And they played against West Ham and he scored 2 goals and got a standing ovation from the West Ham fans. And that has always stuck in my mind. It's a pivotal thing for me. And then poor old Georgie's self-destruction, So, but the good, the bad and the bubbly was, it was bubbly.
He had an amazing life.
Yeah, bless him, extraordinary. But I mean, I this huge talent, but he just couldn't cope with it. And also being the first, the fifth Beatle, he was christened. Mm. Footballers were just guys who went on the bus with you in those days, and suddenly this adoration, and bless him, he couldn't cope. But yeah, he was some footballer.
I noticed Alex Higgins' autobiography was there as well.
You've really been doing your research, haven't you? That was really, I was actually quite sad, because all through it, he is bitter. Mm. That wasn't my fault. This happened. Someone else did this. I didn't hit her. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And again, a genius on the snooker table, but a mess otherwise as a human being. And you just have to read it and think, oh, Lord, and feel sorry for him, really. Mm. But it was a great sense of bitterness through the whole thing.
Coming back to the football, one series I saw you recorded that looked great fun was Dino FC.
Oh, yeah, that was great. I did those. I don't have kids, so I didn't know. My knowledge of kids' books is rubbish, really. And I really enjoyed that, really enjoyed those. And the nice thing is, when you're doing dinosaurs, you can do any voice you like, and you can make up the voices for the dinosaurs. And that was great fun. And I really enjoy, I love doing kids' books. I've done quite a few kids' books. I can't think of the names of any now, but there was quite a few there.
There was Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think, is in there,
yeah,
isn't
possibly,
it?
Yeah, that's there. And there was one I did, and I can't remember the name of it, but the Tooth Fairy is in it. But the Tooth Fairy is not this nice person who leaves whatever it is these days, a pound under your pillow. The Tooth Fairy is actually a skinhead thug who steals teeth and sells them on the black market. And he's wearing a tutu, and he comes and gets all your teeth at night.
And he talks a bit like that.
And I had great fun with him. I loved him.
Do you have a preferred genre that you like reading?
Yeah, I think books that have a lot of dialogue, because being an actor, first and foremost, dialogue is my bread and butter. So Roddy Doyle comes to mind with that. And Roddy Doyle started as a playwright. So in fact, the dialogue in his books lift off the page beautifully. And I've done all the Barrytown trilogies. They're in the library somewhere, and various other Roddy Doyle books. And I love doing Roddy Doyle stuff. Funny story about Roddy Doyle, though. My mum was partially sighted near the end of her life, and she used to get audiobooks. And she ended up, of course, getting mine. But I used to get critiques on the phone, and I would get, I don't like that Roddy Doyle. There's a lot of swearing in that. And I said, Mum, you better talk to Roddy Doyle. I'm just doing the book,
How did you get into becoming a narrator?
Bizarrely, I met another narrator. People might know his books, an American reader called William DeVries, Bill DeVries. I met Bill at a wedding. I had just left drama school, and we got chatting, and probably had too much champagne. And Bill said, hey, you've got a nice voice. You should go to the RNIB and read books. And that's I fell into it that way.
Wow. And as you say, I mean, you've covered an enormous range of books. Some of the best Irish literature of the last 25 years. Frank McCourt, yeah. Angela's Ashes.
Fantastic, yeah. And I'm from Limerick as well, so Angela's Ashes was very poignant and pertinent. Yeah.
And Patrick McCabe as well.
Oh, I was thinking about that today, The Butcher Boy. He's just written a new book, actually. I saw a review in the paper, and I can't remember what it's called. Normally, when I do audiobooks, I do a lot of preparation on them beforehand. So I'm reading them beforehand, I'm marking them up, I'm doing all that. When we did The Butcher Boy, it was such a shocking... It shocked me on every page. I said to whoever was producing it at the times, way back in the old days in Great Portland Street, can we just do this cold? I won't even read it beforehand and let it shock. So we tried an experiment and did it that way. And I think it worked because it brought the freshness to, because it's about a psychopath who's killing people all the time. And it was really, truly shocking. Glad you brought that one up, because I really enjoyed doing it. It's a long time ago now. My voice is much younger then, I think.
Is there a book out there that you dream of narrating?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, probably. I mean, this is very personal. A book that was very big for me growing up was The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat. I'm not the right voice for it, so I would never get to do it. And I'm sure somebody august like the late Stephen Thorne or somebody has done it. You know, I don't know, I'm guessing. But it just always stuck in my head, and also with the film with Jack Hawkins and all that stuff. So I mean, it sounds a weird choice, but I just love that book. Yeah.
You mentioned Stephen Thorne and the other narrators, and I'm always struck when I walk past the green room that there's a lovely atmosphere coming out of there, and you're all swapping stories, and you've clearly known each other for a long time. I also noticed that quite a few of you have rituals or little tricks of the trade. Are you one of those people who sort of walks three times Widdershins round the little coffee table, or eats a banana before you go in? And
Banana is vital, because then it stops your tummy rumbling, because once tummy's rumbling, you can't do anything about it. I take my shoes off in studio, and I work in my stocking feet, as they used to call it, all the time. I'm just more comfortable like that. I don't know why I do that. Maybe it might have come from one day I had wet shoes from a wet day. I have no idea. But yeah, there's lovely atmosphere among all the... Because all the narrators, readers, whatever you call us, we've all been knocking around... Well, a lot of us have been knocking around quite a bit. And we meet in green rooms, both here and in commercial studios quite a bit. So we know each other. And because each voice is so particular to the book, the way the casting is done, there isn't a sort of a jealousy about, oh, I really wanted to do that book, or I wanted to... So that's quite nice.
I understand that it's not just audiobooks that you've narrated. You had a rather interesting job during the 1980s, didn't you?
I did, yes. I was the voice of Gerry Adams for Channel 4 News. Oh, it was mad. It was just stupid. I actually got the job through a friend who said, I'm doing the voice of Gerry Adams for Channel 4 News, but I'm going off on tour with a show. Would you like to take over the job? Now, I'm not from Northern Ireland. I'm from Limerick in the south of Ireland, but I can do a passable Northern Irish accent. And I used to pitch up at Channel 4 whenever they wanted me. And Jon Snow would do an interview with Adams. Adams might be in Derry or in Belfast or wherever he was. And I would watch this. And then we would, because of the government ban on terrorists not being heard on TV, they insisted that Adams' voice and other people like Martin McGuinness were voiced by an actor. And I was that actor.
And it started off being lip-synced, and...
Yeah, we used to lip-sync it, and he was really hard to lip-sync because he mumbled, and Jerry was and he had a big beard. And then there were questions in the House, apparently. Channel 4 bosses were brought into one of those subcommittees you see on the TV saying, we don't believe it's an actor, we think it's Adams.
Just so, too convincing.
Well, there you go. I mean, it's quite a compliment, I suppose, in one sense. So what they decided to do then was that they would run my voice ahead of the lip sync, if you like. So, of course, I just, anytime I met voiceover friends, they just said, you're not doing that very well, you're not in sync. But that was the way Channel 4 agreed to get over this worry that it might be Adams. It was a silly time, but it was very lucrative, so that was fine. And then it stopped, and then I went back to being poor again. You know, so.
But I suppose in some ways it comes full circle, because you're doing a Northern Irish accent now in the Talking Book Studios for the Adrian McKinty books.
Adrian McKinty books, yeah, completely. Yeah, so there we are.
Well, thank you ever so much, John Cormack, for giving up your lunch hour to come in and talk to us at Read On. And I will be listening out for the new Sean Duffy.
Sean Duffy is the hero, that's right.
Thank you very much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you, Red.
She met Malachy at a party given by Dan McAdorney and his wife Minnie on Klassen Avenue in Brooklyn. Malachy liked Angela, and she liked him. He had a hangdog look, which came from the 3 months he had just spent in jail for hijacking a truck. He and his friend, John McAlane, believed what they were told in the speakeasy, that the truck was packed to the roof with cases of canned pork and beans. Neither knew how to drive, and when the police saw the truck lurch and jerk along Myrtle Avenue, they pulled it over. The police searched the truck, and wondered why anyone would hijack a truck containing not pork and beans, but cases of buttons.
My guest, John Cormack, narrating Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt, which is TB11434. For a full list of the wide range of titles that John has narrated, search the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Manjeet Mann to hear the books of her life, another of the great pleasures of hosting Read On is the constant supply of great recommendations that I receive from listeners and guests alike, and sometimes the same title just keeps on coming up. This happened again last week when Lauren Wolk was choosing the books of her life. She recommended All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2015 and has become an international bestseller.
But here's the thing. I tend to give books with fictional blind characters a miss, particularly if the author is sighted. It's always the same old clichés. A stricken victim, usually female, or a hero with sensory superpowers, usually male. And invariably, they're all completely sightless, unlike the majority of real blind people. So when I first heard that All the Light We Cannot See featured a young blind French girl stranded in war-torn France, I thought, here we go again, it's bound to be mawkish. What changed my mind was the enthusiasm with which even those who know my views on blind fiction greeted the book. And then the Bloomsbury Book Group, which includes several VI members, emailed to tell me that All the Light We Cannot See was the most unanimously popular title they'd ever chosen. I knew my time had come to read it. Set in France and Germany before and during the Second World War, the story follows the fates of Marie Laure, a blind Parisian girl, and Werner, an orphan from the mining district near Essen. Both are motherless. Werner and his sister Uta are cared for by a French nun at a children's home. Marie Laure lives with her beloved and doting papa, who is a locksmith at the Paris Museum of Natural History.
At home in the evenings, her father stows their shoes in the same cubby, hangs their coats on the same hooks. Marie Laure crosses 6 evenly spaced friction strips on the kitchen tiles to reach the table. She follows a strand of twine he's threaded from the table to the toilet. He serves dinner on a round plate and describes the locations of different foods by the hands of a clock. Potatoes at 6 o'clock, ma chérie. Mushrooms at 3. Then he lights a cigarette and goes to work on his miniatures at a workbench in the corner of the kitchen. He's building a scale model of their entire neighbourhood. The tall windowed houses, the rain gutters, the laverie and boulangerie, and the little place at the end of the street with its 4 benches and 10 trees. On warm nights, Marie Laure opens her bedroom window and listens to the evening as it settles over the balconies and gables and chimneys, languid and peaceful. Until the real neighbourhood and the miniature one get mixed up in her mind. Tuesdays, the museum is closed. Marie Laure and her father sleep in, They drink coffee thick with sugar. They walk to the Pantheon or to a flower market along the Seine. Every so often they visit the bookshop. He hands her a dictionary, a journal, a magazine full of photographs. How many pages, Marie-Laure? She runs a nail along the edge. 52? 705? 139? He sweeps her hair back from her ears. He swings her above his head. He says she is his émerveillement. He says he will never leave her. Not in a million years.
The museum houses a supposedly cursed diamond known as the Sea of Flames. When the Nazis invade Paris, the diamond is entrusted to Marie-Laure's father. They flee to the Normandy town of Saint-Malo, where, as in Paris, her father builds Marie-Laure a model of the surrounding area so that she can find her way around. Meanwhile, Werner, living in dire poverty, has discovered an old radio that he painstakingly repairs.
Static. Static. He's about to hand the earphone to Jutta when, clear and unblemished, about halfway down the coil, he hears the quick, drastic strikes of a bow dashing across the strings of a violin. He tries to hold the pin perfectly still. A second violin joins the first. Jutta drags herself closer. She watches her brother with outsized eyes. A piano chases the violins, then woodwinds. The strings sprint, woodwinds fluttering behind. More instruments join in. Flutes, harps. The song races, seems to loop back over itself. Werner, Jutta whispers. He blinks. He has to swallow back tears. The parlour looks the same as it always has. Two cribs beneath two Latin crosses. Dust floating in the open mouth of the stove. A dozen layers of paint peeling off the baseboards. A needlepoint of Frau Elena's snowy Alsatian village above the sink. Yet now there is music. As if, inside Werner's head, an infinitesimal orchestra has stirred to life. The room seems to fall into a slow spin. His sister says his name more urgently, and he presses the earphone to her ear. Music, she says. He holds the pin as stock still as he can. The signal is weak enough that though the earphone is 6 inches away, he can't hear any trace of the song. But he watches his sister's face, motionless except for her eyelids. And in the kitchen, Frau Elena holds her flower-whitened hands in the air and cocks her head, studying Werner. And two older boys rush in and stop, sensing some change in the air. And the little radio, with its four terminals and trailing aerial, sits motionless on the floor, between them all, like a miracle.
Not only does the radio offer them a window on the world beyond their poverty, it provides Werner with a way out. His talent for repairing radios is spotted, and he is sent to an elite but brutal military academy to be trained as a son of the Third Reich. Soon he's working on radio tracking devices to help the German war effort. Meanwhile, a German gem specialist has got wind of the Sea of Flames and has started a relentless search to track it down. The opening chapters are set in 1944. Saint-Malo is under siege following the D-Day landings, and so the reader knows that the three strands of the story have come together, but not how or what will happen next. The imminent threat of death and the youth and vulnerability of Marie-Laure and the gentle Werner compel the reader to turn the pages to find out what fate awaits them. Their backstories have an almost fairy tale quality, told as they are in short alternating chapters between longer passages about the progress of the siege. It's a world of good talismans and bad omens, of wicked souls and benevolent ones, in which the young heroes are innocents abroad. Mary Law's imagination is fired by her ability to read Braille. She explores the world via the pages of Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Charles Darwin's Voyages of the Beagle. Verne's exploration is more mathematical, but, like Mary Law, he discovers a love of learning that transcends the limits that life has put on him, a passion offering a loom on which to spin his dreams, as Dewar so elegantly puts it. The book is extremely well researched and full of insight. The characters are beautifully drawn and the dialogue drives the story forward, often sounding like snatches of radio broadcasts that Verne might have tuned into. I found the reaction to six-year-old Mary Law's sight loss particularly resonant.
Congenital cataracts. Bilateral. Irreparable. Can you see this? Asked the doctors. Can you see this? Mary Law will not see anything for the rest of her life. Spaces she once knew as familiar, the four-room flat she shares with her father, the little tree-lined square at the end of their street, have become labyrinths, bristling with hazards. Drawers are never where they should be. The toilet's an abyss. A glass of water is too near, too far. Her fingers too big, always too big. What is blindness? Where there should be a wall, her hands find nothing. Where there should be nothing, a table leg gouges her shin. Cars growl in the streets, leaves whisper in the sky. Blood rustles through her inner ears. In the stairwell, in the kitchen, even beside her bed, grown-up voices speak of despair. Poor child. Poor Monsieur Leblanc. Hasn't had an easy road, you know. His father dead in the war, his wife dead in childbirth. And now this. Like they're cursed. Look at her. Look at him. Ought to send her away. Those are months of bruises and wretchedness. Rooms pitching like sailboats. Half-open doors striking Mary Law's face. Her only sanctuary is in bed, the hem of her quilt at her chin, while her father smokes another cigarette in the chair beside her, whittling away at one of his tiny models, his little hammer going tap, 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 his little square of sandpaper making a rhythmic, soothing rasp. The despair doesn't last. Mary Law is too young, and her father is too patient. There are, he assures her, no such things as curses. There is luck, maybe, bad or good. A slight inclination of each day towards success or failure. But no curses.
I was hooked from beginning to end. Dewar is a masterful storyteller. And although the book meanders a bit in its middle section, as did the Second World War, it remained a page-turner. The only thing that spoilt it for me was the writing style. Although I got used to the dramatic present tense and the overuse of adjectives and adverbs, the modern Americanisms that litter the story stood at odds with a book set in wartime Europe. Also, it didn't help that the narrator struggled with some of the longer words and names. These, however, are minor grumbles. As entertainment, All the Light We Cannot See is one of the best books I've read this year. At 17 hours long, it's perfect for a long journey or a holiday read. And although it deals with some of the more harrowing aspects of war, it doesn't go in for gratuitous descriptions, making it suitable for older teenagers and adults alike. In many ways, it reminded me of Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier. Both shared the desire to create something beautiful in a time of war. Both are ultimately very moving, thought-provoking stories that have stayed with me a long time after I've read them. And while Mary Law is a victim of blindness who often has to rely on others for help, she is also determined, independent-minded, and alive to her surroundings. Notwithstanding any other inaccuracies in the book, Anthony Dewar has succeeded in creating a realistic and compelling blind character. in a story with mass appeal. For that alone, he deserves the Pulitzer Prize he won in 2015 and every enthusiastic review that he receives. All the Light We Cannot See, read by Julie Teal, is available as TB22201. Do you have a book that you'd like to recommend to the other listeners? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the Talking Books library? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, radio@rnib.org.uk, and we'll try to feature it on the show. Now it's back to Manjeet Mann for the books of her life.
Manjeet, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, and that book would be Roald Dahl's Boy. And I think it's because I loved all of his books. I read all of them cover to cover. Massive, massive fan. But then when Boy came along, and it was my sister gave it to me, she said, "This is amazing, read this book," and she just put it into my hands. It was like, oh, there's just something so special about reading about an author's life who you just love so much. So I felt like I was like reading one of his secrets and just sort of finding out about his childhood. And I just could not put this book down. And even now when I think about it, I get a bit of a sort of like, it's like a visceral reaction. It's like I just remember just staying up really, really late with a torch. And like I just couldn't put it down. I just read it in one gulp. And then I think I finished it. And then I started reading it all over again the next day. It was just reading about my hero, his real life stories, and I just loved it.
Down the drive we went and out into the village of Llandaff itself. Fortunately, there were very few vehicles on the roads in those days. Occasionally you met a small truck or a delivery van, and now and again a private car. But the danger of colliding with anything else was fairly remote, so long as you kept the car on the road. The splendid black tourer crept slowly through the village with the driver pressing the rubber bulb of the horn every time we passed a human being, whether it was the butcher boy on his bicycle or just a pedestrian strolling on the pavement. Soon we were entering a countryside of green fields and high hedges with not a soul in sight. "You didn't think I could do it, did you?" cried the ancient sister, turning round and grinning to us all. "Now you keep your eyes on the road," my mother said nervously. "Go faster," we shouted. "Go on, make her go faster. Put your foot down. We're only doing 15 miles an hour."
Ian Craig narrating Boy, Tales of Childhood by Roald Dahl, which is available from the RNIB library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm a real fan of David Almond, and I love Skellig. I just think it is perhaps one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. I'm also really into angels as well. So I just love the way that he brings that kind of otherworldly element into it, but in a way that you just wouldn't expect it. So I just find it really surprising. It's really emotive, and oh my gosh, does it punch you in the heart. I recently reread it, actually, probably like the fifth time. I just love it. I love David Almond, and I think Skellig is a work of art.
I leaned over the tea chests and shone the torch, and there he was. He hadn't moved. He opened his eyes and closed them again.
"You again,"
he said in his cracked, squeaky voice. "What you doing there?" I whispered. He sighed like he was sick to death of everything.
"Nothing,"
he squeaked.
"Nothing, nothing, and nothing."
I watched a spider scrambling across his face. He caught it in his fingers and popped it in his mouth. "They're coming to clear the rubbish out," I said, "or the whole place could collapse." He sighed again.
"Got an aspirin?"
"An aspirin?"
"Never mind."
His face was pale as dry plaster. His black suit hung like a sack on his thin bones. My heart pounded. The dust was clogging my nostrils and throat. I chewed my lips and watched him.
Jim Norton narrating Skellig by David Almond, which is available from the RNIB library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. Wow, I've never read a book like it. It really took me by surprise, and I sort of read it a good while after the booker and everything. And I cannot stop thinking about it. I just think, again, it is just a work of genius. I think it is beautifully told. All these interweaving stories is one of my favourite things. I love it when there are interweaving stories. I love it. Because as you're reading it, and then you get a little surprise about a character that you've already read about a few pages back. I just love all of that. Again, it is just a bit of a punch in the guts and a tug on the heartstrings. It's just got everything. And an amazing end. So everyone's got a real treat in store. It is just fantastic. I mean, come on, she's just an amazing novelist, isn't she? She can't really do wrong with any of the books that she's written. But Girl, Woman, Other, that's going to stay with me for a very, very long time. I think one of my all-time favourite books.
Living rooms became rehearsal spaces. Old bangers transported props. Costumes came from second-hand shops. Sets were extracted from junkyards. They called on mates to help out. Everyone learning on the job, ad hoc, throwing their lot in together. They wrote gra applications on old typewriters with missing keys. Budgets felt as alien to Amma as quantum physics. She balked at becoming trapped behind a desk. She upset Dominique when she arrived for admin sessions late and left early claiming headaches or PMT. They rowed when she walked into a stationery shop and ran straight out again, claiming it had brought on a panic attack. She had a go at Dominique when she didn't deliver the script she promised to write, but was out late night clubbing instead, or forgot her lines mid-show. 6 months after its inception, they were constantly at loggerheads. They'd hid off as friends, only to find they couldn't work together. Amma called a make-or-break meeting at hers. They sat down with wine, a Chinese takeaway, and Dominique admitted she got more pleasure setting up tours for the company than putting herself in front of an audience, and preferred being herself to pretending to be other people. Amma admitted she loved writing, hated admin, and was she really any good as an actor? She did anger brilliantly, which was the extent of her range. Dominique became the company manager, Amma the artistic director.
Anna Maria Nabiri narrating Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo, which is available from the RNIB library.
Manjeet Mann, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks again for having me. It's been a joy.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL. And Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.